You're on the Plants Grow Here podcast. I'm Daniel Fuller. Come along with me as we enter a hidden world of deep horticultural, ecological, and landscape gardening knowledge with featured experts, industry professionals, and enthusiasts.
In case you haven't noticed, the biological diversity on our planet is at risk. In this episode, we take a step back and examine the concept of biodiversity with a Twitter friend of mine, Dr. Richard Bates. He's a dental surgeon and passionate botanist that works with the Northwest Rare Plants Initiative along with Joshua Stiles from episode 17. And he's also a part of the Wildflower Hour team on Twitter. G'day Richard, welcome to the show, mate.
Cheers, man. Good to be with you.
So can you tell me a little bit about your work with the Northwest Rare Plant Initiative, or NWRPI?
Oh yeah, the Northwest Rare Plant Initiative's amazing. It was set up by a close friend of mine, a guy called Joshua Stiles, you've had on here.
Yeah.
Josh is a really quite incredible character. He really is. He's fiercely intelligent. He's very sharp. And he's on a similar wavelength to me. And Josh, like me, I think he becomes frustrated by the wider issues surrounding, you know, the current problems we're having these days, in that a lot of people try and make problems in the world all about them or all about people, whereas I think Josh and I see beyond that, and we sort of look at the plants themselves, which is kind of the important part, really. And I've been involved in a couple of reintroduction projects with Josh, which is, I mean, it's been very rewarding for me personally. Helped with the reintroduction of some green-winged orchids, and yeah, the current. I've not actually been able to get to the sites, unfortunately, due to various commitments. But I know that at all the sites we've reintroduced them to, the green-winged orchids are doing very well, and there's actually been evidence of propagation at one of them. So it's wonderful to kind of see that, really, that, you know, something we've put back there is doing well, and it's not just clinging on for dear life; it's actually improving. So I think long term, I'd like to see how those go. I've also been involved in a couple of other plant projects, which probably won't talk about because I know one of them is currently being written about by another good friend of mine, a guy called John Dunn. Both of these guys are on Twitter, by the way. If anybody listening doesn't follow those guys, yeah, you should seriously get on with following them both. And it's that's been very rewarding. In terms of what else to do, I mean, I'm members of various trusts. I'm a member of the BSBI, who are a really wonderful organisation. They're responsible for, yeah, a lot of research in this country. They've got, yeah, some really good sort of roadmaps for, you know, preservation of species, and you know, they're sort of one of the first places I go if I want to learn about something. And since I've been involved with the BSBI, I mean, I joined, I think it's 4 years ago, 5 years ago maybe. Yeah, I've become a much better botanist for being with them, because there's just so much stuff available, you know, to help. I mean, you can never know anything. And I think, you know, in the past I was very guilty of just sort of being interested in just what I was interested in. But it's allowed me to see a much broader and bigger picture with things. But I guess one of my big concerns is, you know, being involved in, you know, a sort of fairly low level I am at the moment, is that when you start working with a good organization, and when you, you know, it sort of makes you look at other organizations and think, well, what actually are you doing? If anything, what are you doing to help? Because all you seem to do is make things worse. There are various organizations out there who I look at and they make me frown or cringe. And I just think, well, are you in it for the organization, or are you in it actually because you've got, you know, you've got a mission statement that you want to stick by? Because I find it difficult to see where your interest in the actual sort of mission is, if that makes any sense.
Totally. So, Richard, the term biodiversity has two parts to it. Can you explain what we mean when we speak about biodiversity?
Well, I can try. I like to talk about biodiversity as being the sort of the quality of life, if you will. It's not just necessarily the amount of it. I mean, if you look at a field of crops, for example, you've got lots and lots of life there. You've got a big field of corn. There's lots of volume. If you took all that corn and bunched up, you've got this big block of, you know, sort of life and genetic code and whatnot, but there's no variety there. It's just one thing.
No diversity.
Yeah, and it's not interacting with anything. It's taking nutrients out of the soil and I guess if it's intensively farmed, there literally is nothing else there. And then one day somebody comes along, picks it all up. It doesn't interact with anything, and then we eat it. And then kind of that's it, really. It is what it is. I guess the biodiversity there is what happens when it comes out the back end of us, I guess, and we flush it down the loo. Yeah, the biodiversity there is incredible in many respects, but it's not necessarily a good type of biodiversity, that. If you compare that, however, when I was a teenager, my favourite sort of sites to go to were bogs. I grew up just outside Birmingham, a place called Sutton Park, and there were these big bog communities there of sundews and butterworts and all sorts of things. And I could not get over the biodiversity of those places. I mean, literally every kind of invertebrate you can think of, all sorts of mushrooms and, you know, weird little plants, really specialised little things as well. And I remember one day, I was about 8 or 9, I remember finding this water spring at the edge of the bog. And inside the water spring, there were just frogs, there were sort of fish, there was all sorts of stuff. And I remember thinking, this water spring here is responsible for the creation of this entire habitat. And at this part of the water spring here, which is very different to the bog, there's all kinds of other things growing here. And this is all connected in some way, shape or form. And that's what I mean by biodiversity. It's this huge sort of network of things all interacting with each other, all creating this big ecosystem. And every little bit and, you know, frog and the sundew and the fungi under the soil, which are changing things over, they've all got a niche, they've all got a role to play. And that concept, that biodiversity, that concept is pretty much fundamental for the way life on Earth works. Because without these little bits and bobs doing their thing, it stops conditions being made for something else. And I guess in many respects, if you take a look at the ecosystem as a whole, there is a massive general mutualism where this bit does this bit and this bit does that bit. There is no good or bad, if you know what I mean, in that ecosystem. But some things will sort of threaten to sort of unsettle that in some way, shape or form. And some things will obviously, you know, sort of contribute better to it, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And I think biodiversity is something that's massively overlooked. And I think that's very much a human thing. You know, people see what's in front of them. They'll go, oh, look, a bird, or oh, look, a tiger. But they won't think about, you know, what that bird does when it's out of sight. You know, that bird is, you know, it's hard life being a bird. It's fighting for its life all the time. It's going and finding insects and things. And I think us in general, if we go, you know, annihilating, you know, insect levels because we go and spray everything with pesticides and whatnot, then your birds are going to disappear. And I think, you know, the stuff underneath never gets any credit because we either can't see it or we just disregard it.
Or it's not cute and cuddly.
Absolutely. You know, someone I know talks about celebrity species. And, you know, if you've got a big field of bright flowers, people go, oh, look, wildflowers. Well, what do you mean when you say wildflowers? That big bright field of flowers is not wildflowers. It's something that somebody put there to appease you and make you go, oh, look, that's pretty. It's not necessarily doing something good for the biodiversity, so to speak.
It may or may not be.
It may or may not be. I mean, we can always argue. Yeah, and we've all got differences of opinions on things. My idea of a biodiverse area is probably very different to other people's, but biodiversity is seen across a variety of habitats. I talked about bogs, but you've got established woodlands and whatnot. People often think that I'm having a go at farmers and whatnot. Not at all. Some of the best sites I can think of are on traditionally managed farmland. And where I live here in Silverdale, there's a lot of farmland here that's managed. I mean, I think it's managed brilliantly. We've got so much wildlife as a result of it. I think if we were to sort of go all in, intensive on it, it would be lost. It would be lost very, very quickly. So yeah, that's what I mean by biodiversity.
Yeah. So I guess it's in the name, isn't it? Biological diversity.
Absolutely.
So how has evolution played into the diversity of the life forms on this planet?
Well, do you know what, mate? That's a huge question. And I guess here the importance is keeping that succinct, so to speak.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, we could do episodes and episodes of that.
Yeah, we could do episodes and episodes on these things. I mean, the thing about evolution is there's a lot of opinion about it, and there is so much noise around evolution. Do you know what, mate? I'm going to tell you something funny. When I was at university, I remember we were doing some work on various bits and bobs, and I remember somebody used the word evolution. Bearing in mind, we're all studying, you know, a degree with a very, you know, heavy sort of science basis to it. And this was all the biological sciences part of the degree, not actually anything to do with, you know, drilling holes in teeth. And somebody in the corner just piped up and went, evolution didn't happen. And somebody goes, what? She goes, evolution didn't happen. And I just remember saying, well, what about dinosaurs? And they said dinosaurs didn't exist. And I could not believe for the life of me that somebody who is now walking around, you know, professing to have a scientific degree, absolutely rejected the idea of evolution. And absolutely, you know, if you try arguing with me, then you're against God, and God will smite you. I remember thinking at the time, wow, that's incredible. Now, obviously, that's one of the many views on these things. And there are obviously people who sort of accept evolution. There's so many different theories involved and so many different sort of takes and interpretations on it. It's sometimes actually difficult to pick out the important bits and sort of ignore the minute details that people disagree on. But evolution is basically where, over time, progeny of each successive generation changes to the point where, after a long period of time, those descendants have sufficiently changed so that they're no longer the same as their ancestors. So, you know, if you take a look at it over really long periods of time, you could say, well, I don't know, fish coming out of the sea and then sort of dinosaur. Yeah, that is obviously, you know, huge difference between them that takes lots and lots and lots of time. But I guess where evolution, you know, if you scale it back a little bit, the definitions of what makes something different to another thing is not so clear cut. And when you talk about, you know, what something is, the human construct we use to identify things is to describe something as a species. And
yeah,
what defines a species is not necessarily, you know, an easy thing to define. And this is something I love firing off at tangents when talking about these things. If you take a look at a species that you find in lots and lots of different places, how can you say that that species, if it grows on top of a mountain, is exactly the same as one that grows on the edge of a desert at sea level the other side of the world? You know, genetically, these things will have a history associated with them, and they will have different adaptations to those environments. But genetically, they may be very similar, they may be very different, they may look very similar, but actually be very different underneath. Sometimes defining what a species is can be really tricky. I mentioned previously that if we just accept a species as a species, every species has kind of got a niche. So if you talk about evolution and things changing over time, then I guess one of the easiest ways of you know, defining evolution is that progeny of something will occupy a wholly different niche to what things did previously. And if you take a look at that position in the system, that's kind of the driving force behind a lot of it. I mean, some of the tropical rainforests, for example, have got incredibly diverse ecosystems, and there's loads of species with super specialist, sort of very highly adapted sort of roles within that. And those systems are quite adaptable. Things can, you know, various factors can influence it and change things. And I guess that change is sort of the driving factor of evolution and what creates things and makes things change between generations. If things never change, then I guess everything would always be the same. It's worth bearing in mind that the world is an ever-changing place, and things will keep changing, species will keep changing, and it's largely because of those factors that influence that change. One of the, I think, the big sort of disagreements I have is whether or not you look at those factors as, you know, the evolution as being something inherently underneath which causes an organism to change to adapt to what's going on, or whether things get lucky, so you get a beneficial change, for example, and, you know, one species will, you know, put into a position of stress, will never adapt to it because it's never lucky enough, whereas another one will change because, you know, the adaptations it makes are advantageous to the change in circumstances or whatever, and things go from there. One of the problems is that because some changes happen very rapidly and some changes happen slowly, one of the things that sort of confuses us about a species is that sometimes a species will change, it'll become another species. You've still got the other species existing in another area. then things will change again. Those species get introduced to each other again, and then you get hybrids forming between them, and then that species will go off and do this. So sometimes the actual sort of evolution part of things, it's very difficult, you know, thousands, millions of years later, whatever, looking at a situation and saying, oh yeah, that one came from that one, and that one came from that one, and that one came from that one, because the lines are incredibly blurred. And I think evolution is, if you take a look at what evolution is, I guess it's the succession of life in many respects. Your life is constantly adapting and changing to the stresses put upon it. And I've always thought that the species concept that we use to define something as this and that is kind of invalid, because plant growing out there or a monkey sitting on a tree doesn't care what we call it. It just is what it is. And that's kind of the way I look at evolution. It's a very complicated thing that we try so hard to define as something, but it kind of is what it is.
It is what it is. Like many things in life, I guess.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So can you describe what phylogenetic diversity means?
Phylogenetic diversity is it's a measure of biodiversity, which incorporates the sort of the differences between things. I guess I'm probably looking too deep into that question, but it's a way of sort of trying to sort of talk about the degree of separation. I mean, it's something we talk about in orchids, for example. If you take a look at a lot of the sort of genetic analysis of them, you can almost figure out how long ago something existed by taking a look at the phylogenetic tree. But I guess the concept of it has been, I guess it's a difficult concept to follow in many respects, because a lot of species sort of, I mean, it's used a lot in conservation these days. And the thing is that a lot of people these days will focus on evolutionary distinct species. And I think phylogenetic diversity is a good thing, but in many respects, it sort of goes back to what I was saying about various species and concepts of them. I think sometimes with these species trees, we end up focusing too much on one thing rather than the sort of the broader picture of everything, if that makes any sense.
So you've got a bunch of Proteaceae members, maybe. Like, we've got some great diversity. We've got some Proteas. We've got some Banksias. We've got some Waratahs, you know. But actually, all of these plants belong to a single phylum. So if we were to maybe also introduce some Melaleucas in there from the Myrtaceae family.
So I guess looking at it, one of the big problems with phylogenetic diversity as a concept is that it leads to a sort of a greater preservation of, as you say, that phylum, that feature diversity rather than species richness alone, if that makes any sense.
Right. Can you explain what you mean by species richness alone?
Well, I guess it's the number of different species within a particular area. So it's just simply a number.
We've got 3,000 species of plants, but they're all Fabaceae.
Yeah, well, absolutely. If you were to say, I've got 3,000 species of plants growing in my garden, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's a huge amount going on in there. I could have just simply just built 3,000 little blocks and just put a plant in each one of them. Species richness is just simply the number of things there. So it's different to diversity, because the diversity sort of takes into account sort of how things get along with each other, so to speak. And I guess the evenness of it, I mean, we can talk about species evenness, diversity, all sorts of things. I guess that the richness is just simply those numbers. So if you've got one of something within a community, that sort of counts to the species richness. It's sort of a number tool more than anything. I mean, it can be very interesting, because, you know, a species rich area will normally have big species diversity. You know, and if you take a look, I guess, at some areas, the species richness can be very important, because if you go to an island, for example, you'll get huge numbers of endemics and things like that. So you'll have large numbers of different species lying around. Whereas if you go to some areas, you'll have comparatively less. There'll be sort of more of a sort of a generalist kind of thing.
Well, I guess let's speak about the opposite now. What's a monoculture?
Well, a monoculture is pretty much where you just get just sort of one thing, really. I mean, I think monoculture is a sort of an agricultural term.
Yeah, it can be monocrop, monoculture.
And I mentioned it at the beginning of the podcast, you got your field of corn. So pretty much everything is wiped out. and it's used mainly to sort of increase efficiency. So a monoculture, basically, you know, say you're growing potatoes, you don't want potato blight. If you're growing corn, you don't want your ergot funguses growing in it. So you're effectively selectively annihilating everything that can, you know, around it in order to just simply produce one thing and one thing alone. Yeah, I mean, one of the, you know, the big monocultures that people talk about is palm oil. You know, I guess tea is another one of them. And it, I mean, you talked about we talked about edaphic things at the beginning of the podcast. If you just simply hit one area really hard and you encourage just one set of things to grow, that will have knock-on factors for the area around it. So, for example, the soil will degrade. You know, the local invertebrates will either get poisoned by all the chemicals being used to create the monoculture, or, you know, if the area previously was a big thriving, you know, rainforest and you've sort of knocked it all down and now it's just replaced with, you know, African palm oil producing plants, you've got no interaction between them. So the knock-on effect can be huge, and it absolutely annihilates diversity. You know, and I think if you sort of look outside of agricultural practices, humans are very good at creating monocultures. You know, people will look at a garden, for example, and they'll get rid of all the other plants in there, and they'll just create a lawn of grass, sort of mow it intensively every few days. That in itself is a monoculture. If you take a look at a lot of central business districts in cities, and more these days in people's homes, you know, you'll have block paved driveways with a single tree in there or something like that. Those are, in many respects, monocultures, because there's just so little there.
Exactly. So when it comes to someone's lawn, how would you recommend they can up the genetic diversity within that space? They don't have any garden beds, it's all lawn.
Well, if they've not got a lawn.
All lawn, sorry. No garden beds.
No garden beds. They've just got a lawn.
Yeah, all lawn. They've just got all lawn.
Well, I guess my garden, I'm really lucky. Where I live at the moment, I mean, garden I've got is effectively an extension of the limestone grasslands that we have around here. And at one point before, yeah, this cottage was built, you know, hundreds of years ago, this whole area here would have been a massive sort of pasture with all sorts growing on it. And our garden is sort of a little reflection of that. Now, interestingly, the previous owners of this absolutely hammered that garden space quite heavily. And since I've moved and I've just let it grow, yeah, we've got orchids popping up in the back garden. And a couple of days ago, I went out to the back garden near where I planted a tree the other day, and there's 30 adder's tongue ferns coming up. I mean, these things are, you know, uh-huh. These things are typically only seen in sort of quite, you know, mature grassland areas. They're certainly not sort of pioneer species, if you get them adrift. They form quite complicated relationships with fungi in the soil. And I remember thinking, wow, this really is an incredibly biodiverse area. And the richness, you know, and diversity here is quite incredible. And I'm going to put that straight into anybody with a lawn. I guess in many respects, it depends what kind of lawn you've got. If your lawn is effectively a relic of what was there a long time ago before people arrived, then there is actually quite a high chance there'll be an awful lot in that lawn that's not shown itself up for several years and has been surviving for a long time and is sort of waiting to be unleashed again. So I guess the best thing you can do in that respect, if you want to improve the diversity, is just manage it a little bit more sympathetically towards life. There's a big campaign going on at the moment, Plant Life, you're encouraging a no-mow May to see what pops up in your garden. And there's loads of people posting pictures of bee orchids, you know, and sort of all sorts of wonderful ground flora that are popping up. And the thing is, if you've got a bee orchid in your back garden and you're mowing your lawn every week, that bee orchid's not going to go anywhere. I mean, they're quite long-lived things if they don't have the opportunity to flower. Yeah, those things can persist for decades before, yeah, they're going to expire. And as I said, yeah, if you've got a lawn like that, then it you'll have all sorts popping up. If you don't, then, you know, if you've got some turf that's just been laid recently, then there's really not going to be very much there. There's going to be no seed bank. There's going to be no sort of dormant plants underneath it all. And I guess if you want to increase the diversity there, then you're probably going to need to look at, you know, some kind of meadow creation, unless you're literally going to rely on sort of pioneer species coming in on the wind. I mean, if you leave a patch of lawn and just let it be, you're going to get all your thistles, you're going to get your dandelions, you're going to get things like that turning up. But if you want to create something with a sort of a, you know, a nice sort of little biodiverse area, then probably the best thing to do would be to look at, I've mentioned plant life, go and have a look at their things on their website and look at meadow creation. And you can probably think of going to a supplier such as Habitat Aid. They're here in the UK. Yeah, to sort of try and create a sort of a, you know, a meadow species mix. And that will massively increase your biodiversity, but you are introducing everything in that respect. So it's very much a created meadow. But I guess the benefits of that is that if you're introducing sort of native species to an area, especially if you're introducing species that would have normally been found in that area before it was changed by human hands, so to speak, then your garden can interact with the sort of the wider sort of community, so to speak, the wider ecosystem. Whereas I think if you sort of you're living in a lowland area and you suddenly think you want to create a big alpine garden, although you'll have lots of lovely things growing there, it's not necessarily something that's going to interact very well with the local environment. So I think it depends what you're after. I mean, I've got no problem if somebody wants to create a wonderful looking garden, even if it's not necessarily doing anything, because at least you've got something growing there, at least you've got something doing a job. But if you're sort of really looking to sort of be, good for the environment, so to speak, it's always good to try and get a balance and a mix of what should have been there a long time ago, because that's going to support things. That's what's going to get your butterflies in. If you think about, I mean, one of my favourite plants is it's a low growing plant. It's called bird's foot trefoil, one of the lotus species, and it's quite an attractive little plant actually. It's got three little pea shaped flowers all lined up, and it looks like a chicken's foot when it's in flower. I mean, that supports literally dozens of invertebrates. There's all sorts of things that caterpillars eat it. It's visited by all kinds of bees and things, and it's really low growing. So if you're one of these people that wants a really short lawn, if you've got a lovely sort of mix of these things coming up in your lawn, you'll have this wonderful golden spread for several months of the year. You'll have all kinds of bits and bobs visiting it and thriving on it. But yet you've still got your lawn. I mean, if you're like me and you don't mind your lawn being sort of 10 foot tall for most of the year round, then you can just sort of leave it. But that doesn't necessarily make it a usable space if you get my drift. So it's down to how far you want to take it. I mean, I've got ideas at the moment of creating a pond area, because we don't have a pond here, and I do love my herps. I'd love some frogs. We've got frogs in the garden, but obviously there's no pond for them to go laying spawn. They must go somewhere else to do that. But I've thought about having a sort of a small acid bog at the edge and cultivating various I'd love some bog myrtle growing in it. I don't think most people would want that kind of stuff in their garden, but I'm obviously a little bit obsessive and take things a little bit too far with these things. But you can do whatever you want with your own space. I mean, as you said, if you've got a lawn with no bedding, I mean, if you really want to, you can. I mean, don't plant next to your house, because they'll cause you problems. But you can always look at putting a small tree into your garden, because something like that will create so much and bring so much in. And if you put a native species in, for example, that's going to interact with the wider community and help things. But if you want to put a Japanese cherry blossom in, or go for it. I've got a lovely cherry blossom in my garden, and it looks wonderful. I'm sure it'll contribute in some way, shape, or form. But the main reason I put it there is because I like it. I've got loads of other trees in the garden which do a good job. But I guess I keep saying it. You just do what you want and what you can. It's much better to have a lawn and a space than one of these sort of block paved driveways or one of those plastic lawns, which I have a special level of hatred for.
I should mention to our Australian listeners that the no-mow idea probably isn't such a good idea over here, because we have some pretty serious snake problems. So that's more of a UK thing.
Yeah, mate, if I found a snake in my garden, I would not shut up about it.
Well, it'd probably be fine if you found one, but yeah, we can get some bad ones over here.
Yeah, I mean, do you know what, mate? When I was growing up, one of my favourite guys was Steve Irwin. I loved that guy so much. Yeah. I mean, I know he's had various criticism for the way he was, but I mean, he genuinely loved animals. But I just used to love his enthusiasm. He'd be like, oh, look at this, mate. This is a king rattler snake. And if this bites me, I'm 700 miles from the nearest hospital and I've had it. And I just love the way he'd just go and pick it up. And he'd be like, oh, it's really mad now. Obviously a massive showman, but and I'm not saying I'm quite like that. But yeah, I'm fairly experienced at handling snakes. But there are some things that, you know, it's not worth handling. I've handled adders in my time, but I think that's when my bravery sort of outweighed my self-preservation instinct.
So what are the adders like over there? I thought that you guys didn't have too many bad snakes.
We don't. I mean, we've got three native species over here. We've got the adders. We've got, yeah, that's all we've got. And we've got adders. We've got smooth snakes. I mean, those things are incredibly rare. We've got the grass snake. It's actually interesting, actually, that the grass snake we've got over here is, someone did some genetic testing on it a few years ago, and what we've got over here is actually slightly different to what exists over in Europe. So we've almost got our own sort of species in that respect. I'm not sure if it's a true endemic or not. I think it's just found in a certain distribution band. But yeah, I mean, that's what we've got. We've got something that looks a bit like a snake. We've got something called a slow worm, which is a lizard, which doesn't have any legs.
Yeah.
If you take an x-ray of one, you can see it's got little vestigial legs, and that looks a bit like a snake. And then we've got a couple of lizard species. So we're not really blessed over here with reptiles, unfortunately. But what we do have,
not
I mean,
enough,
it's,
eh?
It's last year, actually, during lockdown, yeah, when they allowed us to start traveling, you know, to sort of, you know, out and about to the countryside for the first few weeks. And there was barely anybody about when I used to go for walks. And some of the sites which I've been visiting for years, I was seeing loads of reptiles. And yeah, I think reptiles themselves, they're quite shy. They don't like being disturbed. If you've got people walking around, that they'll disappear out of sight. And I've always had this sort of conversation with people, like, are reptiles much rarer now than they were when I was a kid? Because I remember seeing loads of the damn things. Or is it now that there's just simply, you know, they get disturbed a lot more, so they don't show up as much? Or is it because I'm going at the wrong time of the day now because I've got kids? It's difficult to say. But as I said, one of my observations of lockdown last year was I saw a lot more reptiles than I've seen in previous years. But sadly, I'm yet to see an adder around here, even though I know we do get them. I just need to sort of put myself in the right place at the right time for one.
And are they dangerous? So the adders are dangerous?
Well, kind of. I mean, I guess an adder's pretty dangerous if you sit on one. And an adder's pretty dangerous if you let your dog off the lead and go sniffing through sort of bracken, because it's going to get bitten and, you know, it's going to get hurt. But an adder itself, I mean, they're pretty... It's interesting, actually, because I remember years ago, I went for a walk with my wife down this beautiful place called Dancing Ledge. And as she climbed over a gate, and there was an adder on the wall, and it went absolutely mental. And it actually went for her. She was actually some distance from it. And it was pretty aggressive. It must have been a young male that was, you know, around mating time. Yeah, they get all full of it and have a go at anything. But for the most part, I mean, most adders I've come across are pretty docile. But I guess if you come across across one on the wrong day of the year, then yeah, I guess they are something to be, you know, pretty intimidated by, because you get bitten by one of them, you're going to be pretty poorly.
Yeah. Okay. So they won't kill you, but they'll make you sick.
No. Well, I guess if somebody pretty, you know, somebody medically frail, yeah, okay, was bitten by one, then you'd probably. Yeah. But yeah, I think if an adder bit me, I'd probably obviously be quite badly injured. I've actually met a couple of people over the years who've been bitten by an adder. I remember walking I was a little boy at the time. I remember walking in the Wyre Forest in Worcestershire, and we bumped into a little old lady, and she said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm looking for adders." And she goes, "Oh, I haven't seen an adder in years." I said, "Well, there's one right there." And she goes, "Oh, yes. Oh, well, yeah, I tend to give them a bit of a wide berth because one bit me when I was a little girl." And I was just like, "Wow, really?" And she pulled her leg up. I mean, she was an old lady. She had a massive scar on her leg. And she goes, "Yeah, that's where I was bitten by an adder. And I had to go to hospital." And, you know, back in those days, antibiotics weren't really a thing, so they had to get special approval for me because the area became infected afterwards. And yeah, it was a huge thing for her at the time. Yeah, they got antibiotics, and yeah, I think the secondary infection was what troubled her more than the actual bite itself. But there's quite a few reports of them. I mean, at the end of the day, it's, if you go walking in the countryside, or, you know, you're going to come across wildlife, it's, I always think it's important to know what's around and with you. I mean, I've been bitten by a grass snake. I mean, they're non-venomous. I picked one up a few years ago, and it just sunk its maw into my thumb, and it drew blood. And I was quite surprised. I didn't think a grass snake could do that. I mean, obviously, I was fine afterwards, didn't have any problems. I mean, grass snakes, when you pick them up, first thing they do is crap all over you. It's one of their defense mechanisms. So I was actually more worried about the smell than anything else. But I certainly remember cleaning up my small wound and thinking, "Oh, I'll think twice before picking one of them up in future." I mean, if you can eat a mouse, you can certainly do some damage to my thumb.
Well, yeah, that's right. On my mum and dad's cattle farm, they have quite long grass, obviously, because it's a grass-fed cattle.
Yes.
Just a little hoppy farm. And, yeah, they got snakes there. So they got two deadly ones that can really do some damage. There's the red belly snakes, and then there's the eastern browns. The red belly blacks are not sort of too aggressive, whereas the eastern browns can be very aggressive, and they'll actually chase you down. But
really?
You want the red bellies on your property because they actually eat the eastern brown eggs. So they're the more docile out of the two, so you probably want them on your farm.
Wow. I mean, I know the eastern brown snake, funnily enough, from Steve Irwin.
Yes.
And I know that they're, I think I remember him saying that they're the most venomous land snake in Australia. And I think they're...
Is that right?
I think they might be the most venomous in the world.
Yeah, right. I know they're up there, for sure. Yeah, they're not good.
Oh, yeah, well up there. They are really nasty, nasty things.
There's also the king brown, too.
The king brown. Ugh.
Yeah, that's another one.
I mean, it's funny, you know, because you mention these things, and I do love my snakes, but yeah, having seen so many documentaries and read about these things over the years, yeah, that they really do sort of make me, yeah, they make me jump because I think, oh, I'd love to see one, but yeah, from what you say there, I mean, knowing me, you know, certainly with a British snake, you know, you can be fairly sort of cavalier around them.
Yeah.
But the idea of being chased down by one, because I mean, snakes, this is the thing. People think, oh, they've got no legs. That ain't going to, they can really move.
They can really move.
They can go.
And in long grass, they're invisible.
Yep. Oh, I can imagine.
So you're walking through the paddock and, you know, you've got to wear big gum boots, but even still.
Oh, yeah.
And check your gum boots before you wear them too.
Oh, because they made their way in. It's funny you mention that, actually, because I remember when I was doing reconstructive surgery in hospital, I went on a couple of courses. One of the courses that really frightened me was an Indian chap talking about basically common reconstructive problems in India. And I remember thinking, oh, you know, with the way they drive out there, there'll be loads of maxillofacial stuff. And there was quite a lot of it was talking about sort of repairing people after sort of just the most horrendous kind of car accidents you can possibly imagine. But one of the things that absolutely terrified me was reconstruction of limbs in small children. I remember sitting there thinking, oh, God, this is grisly. Yeah, what's how these kids, you know, sort of, you know, just industrial accidents, things like that. No, it was snake bites. And in parts of the world out there, you think about it, you'll have a village community, you'll have lots of little kids running around, and they'll go running into the grass, and they get bitten by snakes. And what tends to happen is they'll get bitten by the snake, they'll get taken in, the limb will obviously become infected or become gangrenous, and they'll get massive, massive sort of trauma from the actual wider sort of, you know, aspects of the bite. And, you know, if you're living in an area like that and you can't work, you are in big trouble. And a lot of the work that was being presented in this was reconstruction of limbs after snake bites, you know, giving prosthesis, you know, where a child would get bitten by the snake, lose a leg, and then, yeah, they'd be looking at putting, you know, prosthetic leg on, or they'd get bitten by the snake, lose their foot, and then they'd be doing reconstructive work to sort of create that. And I remember the guy said, apparently there are tens of thousands of these injuries, if not hundreds of thousands of these injuries worldwide every year. And I was absolutely gobsmacked. So yeah, so snakes, mate, got to watch out for the things.
So that kind of contradicts our message a little bit about biodiversity, but I guess we're not actually saying that we should be getting rid of snakes. We're just saying we live in a dangerous world.
Awesome,
I guess,
things.
That's the only thing we can say, isn't it? We live in a dangerous world.
We do. And despite our efforts to minimize that, we'll never stop it. It's, you know, it's a game of chance, life is. And when your number's up and you're unlucky, that's it. I mean, you can obviously help yourself by not putting yourself in dangerous situations, but you can never eliminate that risk.
No, that's right. So I guess what are some of the examples of ways that plants, especially looking at becoming endangered, like what are some of the forces that are impacting this?
Well, it's really easy to just say generic human activity is the major driving force with this one, because it's easy to just basically say if humans turn up and dig an area up and build loads of houses, your specialist plants aren't going to grow there. But that's a very sort of narrow-minded way of looking at things, because I've got this genuine belief that we can still live our our lives, you know, even to a sort of a pretty sort of, you know, luxurious standard. But just by changing our ways ever so slightly, we can, we can live alongside things. And I think the major factor for me in this country, looking at things, is that there's lots of land in the UK that hasn't necessarily been built on, but it's been messed with to a certain extent, that things that used to grow there don't grow there anymore. And I think pollutants are probably the something that I think a lot of us are very aware of, but it's largely overlooked. If you've got a limestone grassland and you've got loads of things growing there, if you put a load of cows on it, that's probably not really going to do a huge amount in the grand scheme of things to threaten a lot of what's there. I mean, it might threaten a couple of things and push a couple of things out. But if you start spreading manure over it to improve it, you know, and change all the nitrate content and add too much carbon, then that's going to obviously have a massive effect and wipe everything out. And that's something that we've seen a lot of over the UK. The other thing is, I mean, I've had a few arguments with people with regard to, you know, the use of various pesticides. I mean, glyphosate is something I absolutely hate. Somebody was trying to, yeah, I mean, there are people out there who try and argue that it's relatively harmless stuff.
Yeah, like me. I mean, I have to admit, as a maintenance gardener, I do love my glypho. But yes, I'm not going to put my hand up and say that I know best. Why do you not like glypho?
Mainly because of the wider action it has of just simply wiping everything out.
You mean on a large scale and like agriculture?
Yes, absolutely. It's used pretty, you know, it's basically chucked down all over the place, and you know, being a broad spectrum herbicide, it sort of tends to annihilate just about everything around it. I mean, it's.
But then you got to make bread, don't you? You know,
we do indeed.
I would love to be able to make bread without using monocultures, but I just don't know if we can afford to eat that kind of bread.
Totally agree with you, and that's the thing. I think when we go using these things, I think, you know, I talked last time about what sometimes it's very difficult to come up with. It's very difficult to come up with a solution to a problem when it's such a big thing. I mean, if you take a look at glyphosate in the grand scheme of things, it's fairly sort of low toxicity compared to some of the other things that can be used. But I think it's my worry with the way it's used is I think it's sometimes used and thrown about the place a little bit too much when other alternatives can be used. I certainly don't want to sort of start winding people up because I've kept it fairly sort of tame on a podcast. But you know, there are sort of various systems out there where, I mean, there's one that's going on at the moment which is basically, you know, throw some wild seeds down to create a patch for pollinators. And I've seen examples where patches. A fairly sort of diverse habitat has a load of glypho thrown down, and then a load of sort of non-native seeds are thrown down on top of it. And then somebody goes, oh, look what I've done for the wildlife. And the thing is I get it that glyphosate in its pure form is sort of not as toxic as it has been made out to be in the past, but it is worth bearing in mind that it is still a toxic material. And I've mentioned the effect of chemicals on things. You know, DDT was one. Yeah, that was used in, you know, sort of parts of America. And it's been found, you know, because it's obviously gone through the food chain, it's found to have knock-on effects, you know, on fertility rates in penguins, I believe. You know, because these things basically finds its way all through the food chain across the world. The problem with glyphosate is that if it finds its way into somewhere where it shouldn't be, bearing in mind it's not something that sort of, you know, flows into areas too much unless used to excess. If it comes into contact with an area it shouldn't come into contact with, it just causes massive problems. And yeah, I appreciate as a gardener using, you know, various chemicals is good. But the thing is I would argue that someone like yourself will be using it much more sort of diligently than somebody who just goes down the shops, buys it and starts sort of, you know, chucking it all over the place. I think with a lot of these chemicals, I mean, I think people need to sort of know what they're wielding, if that makes any sense. So I think my problem with glyphosate is not necessarily the glyphosate itself, which I appreciate it has good uses. I just think it's simply the way it's used.
Totally agree.
That's obviously not you change the fact that it's probably carcinogenic. It's
Yeah.
It's probably a lot nastier than people make it out to be. But as I said, you know, it's not as nasty as quite some of the other things out there. I mean, as yes. I said, you certainly wouldn't want to get exposed to it.
No. You should be wearing rubber gloves, avoiding getting it on your paws, especially on your gland areas, like in your groin, on your forehead and stuff like that.
I guess the other thing as well is you might be using it in its pure form, but you will find that you've got various sort of, you know, sort of concoctions that are made up. I mean, there are some sort of commercially available over here, which are pretty sort of toxic sort of, you know, sort of creations.
Oh, yeah. So the blackberry spray is not good.
No, I can imagine. I can imagine.
So, yeah, because that's a hard weed to get rid of. But, yeah, that's some pretty bad-smelling stuff, that blackberry spray.
I mean, with my garden, I mean, I don't use any – the only thing I've actually used is I've taken some cuttings and I've used some doffing mixture to promote root growth on cuttings. That's pretty much the only chemical I use. Yeah, and some people say, why do you make so much hard work for yourself? And in my own head,
I'm passionate about it.
Yeah, I am, hugely so. But, you know, there's a big difference between sort of, you know, oh, I don't like that. I'll stick a bit of something on it to get rid of it. Or, you know, just simply mass indiscriminately spraying large areas with it, which is probably what offends me. Because, I mean, the thing is glypho, I mean, it's unlikely to go getting into water supplies if it's used sparingly, but if you just go absolutely hammering it all over everything, it is going to wash off and it is going to get into your water sources. And that's when you've got a real problem. A lot of aquatic species, they are really sensitive to sort of chemical imbalances.
Yeah. Don't spray near waterways, folks.
No. Don't spray near waterways, folks.
Even if it says in the label it's okay or it's aquatic or bioaquatic or anything like that, just avoid waterways. Don't spray on wet days. Check the weather before you spray. Always mix to the label. And some states, especially in Australia, are going to require you to have a license to spray. So make sure you're doing everything correctly.
I totally agree with that, mate.
Yeah. Who wouldn't? So, Richard, what happens if we lose biodiversity? Like, who cares? Why is it bad?
Well, I think if we lose biodiversity, then we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot a little bit, because if you think about it, we are part of a gigantic, we have a place in the ecosystem, so to speak. I mean, we, as much as we try to artificially create our own ecosystems and remove ourselves from things, yeah, there is still a sort of a big flow, so to speak. I mean, I've read newspaper reports. I've never actually looked too much into it, but I've read newspaper reports over the years of crops failing in various parts of the world because, yeah, there haven't been enough pollinators around to get things going. So things have been hand pollinated, for example. I mean, that's obviously a massive, massive cock up, because if you've hammered an area so hard that, you know, what you're putting in can't develop, then, you know, you're effectively creating mass starvation. So that's one way that you can affect things. But I think the wider context of it is that the reason the world, our planet is actually, you know, habitable is because, you know, life has created it to be so. I mean, if you go back enough millions of years, you know, the conditions on Earth were absolutely horrific, but it was plants that were responsible for converting the majority of the carbon dioxide around at the time into oxygen, which is obviously responsible for us being able to breathe and function. So in many respects, a lot of the conditions that we see worldwide, a lot of the way, you know, wind systems and sort of ocean flows work, is because of gigantic ecosystems. And that's obviously the case locally. If you live near a big forest, for example, you know, you're going to get loads of transpiration off that, and that in itself can affect local weather patterns. So if we go hammering all the biodiversity, then the conditions that we regard as nice and, you know, fun for life will be altered, and altered quite badly. Were it not for all these sort of jet streams and things that, you know, move air and moisture and everything around the place, we would have nothing. In fact, you'd probably have a narrow band of, you know, sort of habitable land in each hemisphere. The equators would probably be incredibly hot. And I mean, certainly where I live at the moment in the UK would be absolutely freezing cold. I mean, you go back to sort of glacial conditions here. So I said that life is responsible in many respects for, you know, a lot of the good conditions around us. So we ignore it at our peril. A lot of people refer to the Amazon rainforest as the lungs of the earth. And at the moment out there, there seems to be it's quite popular to go chopping as much of it down as possible. I mean, chopping it down is I guess it's fine and all that, but if you're chopping it down at a rate greater than it can replenish itself, you've got a big problem. It's a little hypocritical in respect that some governments of the world have turned round and started saying, you're saying to the Brazilian government, oh, it's really naughty, it's really bad that you're doing what you're doing. Oh, by the way, we're building unprecedented rates of, steelworks and coal factories. It's, I think that there has to be a sort of a general appreciation of things, as well as appreciating the big resources we've got.
And I guess with biodiversity loss, the worse it gets, the worse it gets. So maybe you might lose a small herbaceous weedy looking thing, and maybe you think you don't care. But then a certain moth needs that at a certain time of the year.
Yep.
And then, a certain bird eats that. And then suddenly, all of a sudden, just a couple of links up that chain, now you've lost your apex predator.
Yes, absolutely. And the thing is, I mean, looking back on it, some people say, oh, who cares? It's just some dumb animal. But if eliminating a single species or putting a significant, strain on a single species can have that knock-on effect, bearing in mind, I talked about niches earlier, some species will occupy multiple niches, the knock-on effects can be much higher up the food chain. And we are in effect, us humans, we are apex predators. There's not very much out there that eats us, and certainly not to the extent where it's sustaining their place in the wider scheme of things. So if we go, if you go knocking on the head, plants, for example, we've got no oxygen. A lot of the energy that comes in comes from the sun. If you've not got that energy transfer, then we're in big trouble. So
totally.
Yeah, a bunch of dumb animals and plants, they may be, but you're very dumb if you can't appreciate their importance to us.
Yeah, exactly. So Richard, I guess, what do we do? Like, how can each of us, just little people living in the world, going about our day, what sort of changes can we make that can help assist biodiversity within our backyards or even within our apartment balconies?
I guess this is the thing, actually. I keep going full circle when I sort of think about this. I think in many respects, I think the majority of us aren't too bad. I think it's, I've seen breakdowns in the past from various resources where it looks at, per capita in various countries of the world, who are the biggest offenders? I mean, if you go to, some really rural parts of the world, people generally are not really having much of an effect on it. Whereas if you take a look at somebody who's, flies everywhere all the time and, sort of everything they eat is massively processed and, they live in effect an extremely luxurious lifestyle. Those are the people that are causing more damage per head than anybody else. And I think, there's a huge range of opinions on things, in terms of what's good and what's bad. If you really want to say, well, let's look at what's bad, you could say that humans are bad intrinsically, and therefore the best thing to do for the planet is to get rid of all the humans. Well, there have been a few people over the years who've come up with these kind of ideas that have generally been frowned upon. So I certainly wouldn't go endorsing that kind of behaviour. But on the flip side, is having a car a bad thing? Well, yes and no, really, I guess. If you're the kind of person that buys a brand new car every year, and you've got a block paved driveway and, you've got a swimming pool that's heated most of the year and, you're mining for bitcoins and, you've got an oven that's on all the time and your central heating's always turned to the max, then you are probably, you could look at that person and say, well, you're doing quite a lot of damage. So just looking at it on the, in a sensible kind of way without sort of pointing a finger at anybody, I guess the overall message is use as little resources as you possibly can. If you go down the supermarket.
And do the least harm.
Yeah, if you go down, do the least harm. I mean, if you're buying a car, for example, I certainly wouldn't go. I mean, and this is massively hypocritical of me. Don't go buying the 4-liter V8. You've got to ask yourself, is that really necessary? If you're buying food down the supermarket, do you really need to buy beef that's been imported from Argentina? Do you really need to be buying mineral water that's come from Japan? The answer is probably not. And I guess it's making those little decisions that adds up to a big thing. If you can grow your own food, for example, in a vegetable plot, if you can, around here, I tend to only buy food from local organic farmers. I mean, a lot of people would say, well, you touched on it earlier. That's not a sort of a viable strategy for feeding the entire world. And I get that and I agree with that. But it's I guess we've all got to do our own little bit and thing to try and sort of help that. And I think we probably need to embrace the changes that are coming our way to try and clean up our act. I mean, personally, a lot of people talk about carbon and carbon dioxide being bad things. I appreciate that carbon dioxide's a bad thing, but I personally believe that our actions, a lot of that sort of pollutant kind of thing, it's one of the reasons why I'm so much against glyphosate. It's not the glyphosate itself I've necessarily got a massive problem with. It's probably the wider context and the way that people use it and the fact it's a chemical. I think the knock-on effects of using a lot of these things is often overlooked. And I think if they use sort of sensibly and sparingly, they're not necessarily a bad thing. But if they're overused or they're used incorrectly, that's where the problem is. And I think that's what we can do to make the world a better place. If you live in a flat, for example, you could argue that a block of flats is an incredibly efficient way of living because you're not taking up as much space as somebody who's decided to go and buy a big house with loads of grounds covered in concrete. So in many respects, living in a flat, if you've got a little balcony and you want to put some you want to put some potted plants upon your balcony and whatnot, then that's a good thing. But some people turn around and say, but those potted plants that you're buying are grown in horticulture and horticulture is bad. And if you stick a bee brick up, you're just encouraging non-native species to come in. And that bird feeder, where did those nuts come from? I think sometimes you can look at things in too much detail and go overboard with it all. And these arguments exist. You'll find people out there who say, if you put nuts up for your birds in the garden, you're just contributing to global warming. And I think, what? I'll stick nuts up for my birds and I've got absolutely loads of the things. The swings and roundabouts at the end of the day. And I think sometimes it's very difficult to say, yes, this is right, this is what you must do, or no, this is bad, this is what you mustn't do. But I mean, if you go and eat every night at McDonald's and, as I said, you leave your lights on all the time and your central heating's always turned to the max, you are probably, people are probably going to accuse you of being a worse person than somebody who's a vegan who eats, vegetables that they grow themselves at home. We've all got a place. I think we just all need to sort of be aware of what's going on and try and do our bit.
A lot of the time we do know the answers to, it's about not using those chemicals, especially the pesticides as well. The herbicides, yes, but also the pesticides. They're not great.
They're the worst things.
Especially in urban areas, because it's so unfair to your neighbours, because they might be doing their best to avoid using pesticides, but because you're using systemic pesticides, you're having an effect on their ecology.
Of course.
So it's kind of unfair when you think about it.
I guess the thing is, though, is if you take a look at behaviour generally in animals, everything's selfish. Everything's incredibly selfish.
Yeah.
And humans are no different.
That's very true.
Yet the neighbour at the road who does a massive bonfire and covers everybody's gardens in ash, I'm not going to go around to his house, start knocking his door and ranting at him, but, you look at it and you think, you miserable so-and-so. thanks, mate. That's fun. But as I said, you get it, and we are all fundamentally very selfish. I think things will probably get to a point where things will start getting bad, and we'll start looking at our own actions, and we'll clean up out of necessity. But we might not. We might just carry on and just accept it. But it is good, I guess, that there are people like myself and yourself who do look at our wider behaviour and do have an appreciation. And for the most part, we try our hardest to be good. But as I said, you can criticise to a point where it becomes sort of completely unconstructive. And as I said, it's about doing the best that you can, I think, and being aware of that. And I think if everybody was aware of that, I actually genuinely think the world would be a much better place.
Yeah, I totally agree. So, Richard, I've seen a lot of debate online about this sort of native plant versus exotic plant dichotomy. What are your thoughts about exotic plants? are they the devil, or are they actually helping native pollinators and native species as well?
Well, it was quite funny actually, mate, because when I was reading through the questions list, I looked at this one and I actually laughed when I saw it, because I just thought, wow, how do I answer this question without offending people? Because do you know what, mate? I'm a really sort of laid back kind of person. I really am. I mean, I get really wound up about some things, mainly funny enough, professionally. The stuff that winds me up at work, I mean, I try not to show it, but some things really wind me up. But one of the things that I just absolutely do not get is some people just become like so red in the face about things and so spitting mad over stuff that they kind of lose credibility in some respects. And then some people just become so angry and mad about things that you look at and just think, am I like massively ignorant because I'm not, don't feel the same way? Or is this actually like a, you know, is this person just completely bonkers? And yeah, when it comes to exotics and whatnot, I mean, I think exotics are bad because, I mean, I've just admitted earlier to having a Japanese cherry tree in my garden. And if you actually look in my garden, there's loads of horticultural plants. And yeah, I've not waged war on them yet. I mean, I might do at various stages. There's a few Spanish bluebells. Yeah, I don't actually hate Spanish bluebells. Yeah, when I've been over to Spain in the past, I've seen Spanish bluebells. And I'm like, oh, bluebells, they're lovely. But there's a kind of like, that doesn't belong here kind of mentality that I think some of us have got. And I don't think it's that we're like, I mean, I've heard the term plant racist used before. And yeah, I'm being very careful what I say here because I certainly wouldn't want to be taken out of context. But I'm not a plant racist. I mean, I don't have anything intrinsically against Spanish bluebells because they're Spanish. The problem I've got is that I've seen woodlands full of bluebells where Spanish bluebells are sort of infiltrating their way in and changing the, you know, changing the
biodiversity,
the balance of bluebells and the biodiversity in there. And people say, oh, so what? It's just a Spanish bluebell. You know, what's wrong with a Spanish bluebell over a native bluebell? And I would reverse this sort of thing round. It's not me who's missing the point here. It's you that's missing the point. These are native bluebells. The ecosystem here has developed. They're part of our, I'm going to use the word heritage. They're part of our heritage, and you know, they should be there. They're the things that have adapted to be in these conditions because of the very sort of contrived set of pressures put upon them over the last several, you know, thousands of years. So something coming in and displacing them all over a short period of time is kind of changing a naturally occurring thing. And that the reason for that change is entirely driven by humans messing around with things. And the thing is people say, oh, well, what's a Spanish bluebell going to do differently to a native bluebell? Well, the answer is it's probably not a huge amount, but it doesn't change the fact that you are effectively tampering with a sort of a completely naturally occurring and beautiful thing because somebody's too lazy to grow native bluebells instead of Spanish ones. And I guess that's where a lot of the friction comes from it, because people say, well, what's wrong with a Spanish bluebell? It's just a bluebell. It's an invasive species that is displacing what naturally occurs here. You know, and if you look at that in a wider context of things, we have loads of you know, non-native, you know, exotics, if you will, that are coming in and displacing all sorts. I mean, I've been up to the banks of the Findhorn River up in Scotland, looking at an unusual population of orchids growing there, and the site is hugely threatened by something called Japanese knotweed, which is it's an aggressively growing species that takes over vast areas very, very quickly, chokes everything else out, and worse still, it spreads like wildfire. And once it's there, it is incredibly difficult to get rid of. And you know, I think sometimes there are some species that will grow here, you know, exotics, if you will, that sort of pop up and they don't really do too well over here because they don't really fit in. Yeah, and they might remain static. They might sort of grow at very slow rates. But some of these species will come in and they cause a lot of damage. And I guess you can look at it and say, and people will say, oh, yeah, Richard, well, you're saying that, you know, there's not enough plants in the world. And then you've got these plants that are coming in and doing all this. You know, why do you hate them so much? It's because we've talked about biodiversity. We've talked about all of this and all of those things. A lot of these plants threaten our biodiversity. And I guess in many respects, the aversion I have to them is because of that threat that they have. It's another threat in the grand scheme of things. And, you know, exotics versus non-natives. I mean, if you want a garden full of nice plants, go, as I said earlier, go make yourself a garden full of nice plants. It's better to have something there than nothing there. But when these things start escaping from your garden and doing damage elsewhere, like you said, you know, if you're spraying herbicides in your garden and it's knackering next doors, you can shrug your shoulders and say, well, it's nothing to do with me, mate. It's your garden's problem for not being able to, you know, yeah, you need to build a bigger wall or something to stop it from happening. It's a very sort of, I think, in many respects, selfish attitude to say that, you know, you're discriminating against something because you don't like it. Well, there's a really good reason for it. I'm not liking it because it's disliking it because it's Spanish. I'm disliking it because you know, I see it coming in here and threatening what we do.
Yeah, then pollinators might not react the same way to those Spanish bluebells. Yeah.
Well, there's a reason why Spanish bluebells exist. It's because they occupy a different niche. So effectively, I'm not sure the Spanish bluebell would actually have a hugely different role
to
a regular bluebell. I mean, maybe I'm very wrong in that respect, but...
But it might favour one thing more than another.
Exactly. And it changes that balance. And that's the thing. And whether that balance is something that I'm appreciating and it's not going to have any effect on the wider scale of things, or whether it's actually genuinely going to threaten things is open to debate. But exotics are in many respects a bad thing, especially when they start sort of threatening what exists here already. Remember, what we've got here is a very, it's a unique set of things. What grows in a particular area is unique to that area. It's the product of thousands and thousands of years worth of, pressure put upon an area to create that balance that's there. And the fact that, as I said, as humans, we go messing everything up, messing it up even further with another thing, it's something that upsets me. And it probably upsets me disproportionately in the grand scheme of things. But as I said, as somebody who has a sort of an appreciation of things, and I appreciate the purity of what we have as native species, it's something that rankles with me.
Yeah, fair enough too. So as we mentioned on episode 17, we had Josh Stiles on the podcast, and something that he said was that plants are at least as interesting as animals. What do you reckon about that?
Well, obviously, I love plants, and I think plants are way more interesting than boring animals. I guess beauty is in the eye of the beholder, mate, because, what I find amazing and attractive is different to what other people will. I mean, I find the idea of looking at birds through binoculars in a hide for hours on end a really dull, sort of proposition, because the majority of birds to me are sort of small and brown and all look the same. And it's funny because I will then start talking about, the differences between different kinds of pearlworts, which are small green plants that tend to grow between cracks in the pavement, and I'll get incredibly animated about the differences between them. I mean, things like that. I'm not being funny. If you show somebody a little brown bird and then show somebody a little green plant, no one's going to get excited about those unless you are absolutely well into those things. But the thing about plants is that fundamentally I talk about plant blindness. A lot of people will just walk past plants without even noticing them, and unless it's literally like an enormous sort of blue or bright red flower, people will just simply completely ignore them, and then they might just go, oh yeah, that's nice, oh yeah, cool, and then just walk off. People will never find something interesting if that's kind of the way they're wired up. But if you take a look at plants, there is a certain, I mean, plants are savage things, and there's a subtlety to the way that they do things. I mean, where you are, mate, in Australia, you've got a lot of Drosera sundews. I mean, we've got sundews over here. I mean, Drosera is an incredibly successful genus of plants. They're found all across the world, pretty much everywhere except the poles. And these things will, I mean, if you think about it, a plant that secretes a sticky juice which lures insects in, and then when they land on it, it actually just sort of dissolves them. And, the plant absorbs their sort of liquefied juices. I mean, that's like something off a science fiction movie. It's absolutely savage. And if you take a look, Drosera is actually quite closely related to another genus of plants, in fact very closely related to Dionaea, which is Venus flytraps. I mean, those things are literally like something out of a horror movie. You've got a plant with these big jaws, and when something crawls across, it slam. Absolutely. And it traps a fly in there and eats them. I mean, that is absolutely incredible. I mean, I would say to anybody that's not fascinated by that, that they are absolutely numb to stuff, because that is phenomenal. But when you start looking at plants in greater detail, you'll see that the adaptations and their strategies and their methods for dealing with the world are just as varied and interesting as any of the crazy stuff that you'll see on a David Attenborough program. I mean, my big interest obviously is orchids, and I love ferns and I love alpines. And let's just take alpines. The reason I love alpines is, I mean, the definition of an alpine area is it's where it's high enough that trees won't grow, basically. And that you're talking about really sort of hostile conditions. And what amazes me about alpines is that even in these really hostile areas, which are usually very dry, very cold, these plants will try their absolute hardest to sort of make the most of the environment that they're in. They'll have incredible adaptations. But what amazes me is that the flower sizes of a lot of these alpines is enormous in comparison to the size of the plant itself. So if you take a look at some of the gentians that grow up there, you've got these enormous blue flowers which were designed for attracting whatever insects are daft enough to live up there to their, and you look at it and you go, wow, that's incredible. When you actually see these things in habitats, I'll talk about purple mountain saxifrage. When you go up to these areas, which are quite barren, you suddenly see these enormous spreads of these incredible flowers. And you go, wow, that thing is completely, you know, sort of adapted to thriving this environment. But it's probably more spectacular than stuff that grows further down the road, where conditions are generally more favourable towards growth. And it's that sort of, you know, achievement in the face of adversity that really makes me go, wow, that's phenomenal. But there are some plants out there that are just, they take things just a whole new level. Orchids, I could talk about these. I mean, mate, if you talk about, you know, doing podcasts on individual subjects raised here, I could probably do an entire year worth of podcasts on orchids because they are just so phenomenal. They're an incredibly, incredibly diverse sort of set of plants. And they've got so many adaptations to so many different environments that it is absolutely mind-boggling, because the plants themselves are actually really simple. Most orchids, it's three petals and three sepals. But yet the difference in appearance, the difference in the kind of the areas that they exist is just staggering. There's an orchid that occasionally grows in the UK. It's found more across Europe. You've got them in, you've got orchids in Australia, mate, that flower underground. I mean, that is just unreal.
Yeah, we do.
So you've actually got a plant. Yeah, I mean, Epipodium, the ghost orchid, they flower sometimes underground here. They've been observed to do so. But I think that's more because they're sort of failing to provide enough nutrient to get the flowers above ground. If it's flowering within the leaf litter, you're still going to get bugs and creepers crawling into the flowers and doing things with them. So whether or not it's actually evolved to do that, or whether they just happen to do so, I think it's open to debate. But I mean, in Australia, you've actually got flowers that flower underground to sort of attract all sorts of things, worms and stuff. I mean, that is just unreal. But the wonderful thing about those plants is because they never come above the ground, or because they so rarely come above the ground, they have created a relationship with the fungi and the soil around them, which they are completely dependent on. And that fungus itself will grow around the roots of a tree, form a network. And in many respects, the orchid is getting all of its nutrient from a fungus, which is in turn getting all of its nutrient and water from a tree. It's like, wow, what a clever bastard to do something like that.
What a good scheme.
Yeah. I guess the drawback to that is you're so highly specialized that the places that you live in effect, you're kind of rare territories. I mean, they would have been a lot more common a few thousand years ago. Probably the dominant kind of, you know, sort of conditions before we came along. But in many respects, that's still amazing. There are some orchids, and you've got them over in Australia as well. But we've got orchids over here that will fool insects into coming and landing on them to try and mate with them. And that actually pollinates the plant. I mean, that's amazing. You're effectively a sex doll flower. And you are
that's
relying
the bee orchid?
On proper, yes, yeah, the bee orchids offer us, yeah. I mean, there's other orchids in Europe that do the same thing. There's a closely related genus called Serapeus, which does the same thing, although the flowers on that are a lot less exotic. But it's got to the point with these things that some of them actually produce hormones that attract these pollinators. But if you actually take a look within Ophrys, some of them have actually gone beyond that and are just now regular sort of deceit flowers. So they don't have any hormones, don't produce any, but they just look interesting. And, you know, an insect will pop by and go, oh, well, let's have a little look at that. And, oh, there's nothing here. I'll bugger off. And that's the thing that's so amazing. So you've got that kind of incredible level of diversity, even within and sort of methods of pollination, even within a single genus. You mentioned bee orchids, your traditional bee orchid, Ophrys epiphora. In the UK, it's largely self-pollinating. The pollinia, just the moment a gust of wind comes across it, the pollinia will drop into the stigmatic cavity and it will self-pollinate, which is kind of interesting in itself because bee orchids are quite prone to monstrous forms, and you get loads of different variants which have been recognised, you know, across Europe and into Asia Minor. I mean, it's got a phenomenal range, bee orchid. I mean, they grow as far east as Iraq and I think into Afghanistan. Yeah, so that they really do get a long way over. But yeah, you'll also find them on the west coast of Ireland. They're incredibly sort of, you know, successful plant in respect. But as I said, you've got loads of Ophrys orchids. I mean, I've got some popping up in the garden. they are really quite amazing things. And my love of plants, I guess, was created by, it all happened in the same year. When I was just before my sixth birthday, I came across a bee orchid on a canal towpath in Warwickshire, where there's a lot, it's something called the Blue Lias clay area. There's loads of sort of real sort of, you know, calcium loving plants there. And bee orchids love growing on sites like that. I remember coming across this thing. I was like, wow, that is phenomenal. And this thing was growing among the fossils in the ground, which was something I was hugely into as a kid anyway. And then a few weeks later, I went over to Sutton Park and I found some things in flower called butterwort, which is another carnivorous plant. The leaves are sticky. Insects land on them, and they, just like Drosera, they sort of get mulched and eaten. And I remember coming across these things in a bog, and I was like, wow. So you've got a bee orchid that looks like that, and you've got these plants that do that. These things are phenomenal. And as I said, you talk about plants being more interesting than animals. I guess if you're a zoologist and you love animals, you're going to disagree all day long. But I'm going to disagree all day long with them, because for me, I mean, you take a look at plants being responsible for life on Earth as the way it is. Plants responsible for bringing the energy in. Plants responsible for the creation of the majority of habitats out there. They're just incredible. And I think it's a shame that they are so underappreciated. I mean, to a lot of people, plants are just that boring green bit on the edge of a plate when you get a steak and chips. They are far more than that. They are far more than that.
Yes, they really are. So, Richard, I always like to ask my guests one last final question. Is there anything else you want the listeners to know about?
Yeah, I mean, I've name-dropped quite a bit in this podcast. I've mentioned, we've both mentioned Josh. I've mentioned the BSBI. I've mentioned my mate John Dunn. And they're responsible for a lot of maintenance of records. As I said, they do a lot of research. I mean, I'm obviously massively biased because I'm part of the Wildflower Hour team. We've got an ever expanding team. I've got to give a shout out to Rebecca Wheeler and Moira O'Donnell, who are responsible for a lot of the running of the Wildflower Hour account. And we've got Leaf and we've got Josh. Yeah, we've got people like myself as well who do some of the identification, and I guess less of the admin side of things. But the Wildflower Hour was set up by Isabel Hardman, a lovely lass. I mean, she's had to step down recently from a lot of the day-to-day running of the account. But it's a team of like-minded enthusiasts who just love plants, love botany, love being part of a community. I think some people see us as a little bit happy-clappy in some respects, because we are so enthusiastic. But we've got dedicated botanists as part of the team. I mean, we've all got some qualification in respect that sort of lends towards appreciation of biology and botany. And I think we're just sort of really geared up towards sort of getting people interested in things. And it's affiliated with the BSBI. And I'd love more people to get involved with it. I mean, it's Sunday evenings. I mean, I'm terrible at being in a particular place at a particular time. But on Sunday evenings, between sort of, I think it's 8 to 9 o'clock, although it's kind of from 7 till 10 now, really. We just encourage people to post pictures of plants that they've seen out and about. Mm-hmm. We run a little ID service, which sometimes is really busy. Quite often I'll get tagged into trying to identify an orchid that's got people confused, because orchids, I mean, we've not got a huge number of species here. We've got just over 50. In the UK.
Really?
But some of them can produce some pretty sort of wacky looking hybrids, which can be almost impossible to determine. So I often get tagged in those. They're called dactylorizers. But I mean, I take my hats off to a lot of the guys because they're so dedicated to it. I mean, as I say, Rebecca and Moira especially, I mean, they are absolute machines at plant identification, and they're so enthusiastic 24/7 about what they do that I've got to give them a shout out. But I guess if you said, what do people need to go and do? What do people need to go and look at? Well, alpines, ferns, and orchids, go and look at them. They are the most incredible things. That's what people need to do. And they also need to subscribe to your podcast, because I'm slowly making my way through them at the moment.
Oh, really?
I'm thoroughly enjoying them. As I said to you last time, what I'll do is what I've been doing is when I'm going to sleep at night, I'll stick a podcast on, and if somebody's really interesting, I won't go to sleep halfway through.
Oh, good. Glad to know you're enjoying it, mate. Thank you.
No, is at all. I mean, I think it's wonderful that there's a platform for people to talk about things on, because, in many respects, you know, people don't get the opportunity to do so.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's it must take a lot of hard work to sort of get all these things all, you know, put together and, you know, sort of...
Yeah, that does, yeah. I won't
lie. Put them to the world.
But like you say, it's good for people to have a place to talk about things. Like, I think a lot of the time, some of the platforms out there, you already know exactly what you're going to hear a lot of the time. And I reckon... Yes. Sometimes it's good to have people on who disagree with each other. Like, that's part of our mission. And if any of our listeners want to know what our mission is about, you can go and check it out in episode one.
Oh, yeah. With, mate, you'll find loads of people, even people who sing from the same hymn sheet, who disagree with each other.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I have, I wouldn't say arguments, but yeah, I'll wind Josh up and Josh will wind me up. And yeah, I'll say to some of my other friends who've got various interests in other areas, yeah, we'll wind each other up with our differences of opinions, and it's not that we'll have a fist fight with each other, but
no,
we'll certainly sort of have a disagreement of opinion. And I think that's where talking about things and coming together is such an important thing, because you don't want to form a traditional committee where everyone talks a lot and never gets anything done. But on the flip side, when people do bounce ideas off each other and see things from different contexts and viewpoints, that in itself is important to sort of, you know, the overall mission, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I totally agree. We're all on the same page here. We want, I guess, all my guests are on the same page. They want to talk about horticulture, ecology, and landscape gardening, and they're all approaching it from different angles. And when we have two different people who are saying things that appear to be opposing, we can have a wider understanding of the issue, because now we've heard different perspectives.
And I guess that's where we that's the one thing about humans. We are capable of listening to each other. It's just, I wish we did a little bit more of it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, what do they say? We've got two ears, one mouth.
Yeah.
That old cliche. Thanks for coming on the show, mate.
No, it's at all.
There are a range of ways that you can assist with biodiversity, and one of the best places to start is to follow Dr. Richard Bate at The New Galaxy on Twitter, and to check our back catalogue to build on your knowledge base. If you like this sort of content, subscribe and follow so that you don't miss any of our future weekly episodes. And if you have an Apple device, it would mean the world to Ben and I if you could leave us a 5-star review and leave a comment saying what you like about the show. Thanks.
That's probably the kind of distances that living on a little island like the UK, which, by the way, I mean, it's a pretty big island. It can take, if you drive from one end to the other, that's a good few hours. But I mean, Australia, man, you look at the globe and there's this massive sort of thing and you're like, oh my goodness me, that's Australia. It's a big place.
Yeah, I'll just look up Melbourne to Brisbane in kilometres.
I'll stick that into Google Maps.
So it's 1,776 km. So it's a fair drive.
Oh my god, that is one heck of a journey. That is. It's quite funny actually. I've just typed in Melbourne into Google Maps, and I found out there's a Melbourne in Derby.
Oh,
right. Here in the UK. So
there you go. I know there's one in Florida too.
Oh right. Well, there's something for the bucket list. Visit all the world's Melbournes.
Melbourne.
It's quite funny actually. I'm just.
Did you just say Melbourne?
There. Melbourne in Derby. Yeah.
You just fell victim to one of the classic blunders. It's Melbourne.
Melbourne?
Forget all the vowels between B and N.